ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The new horror movie Obsession confirms what most of us who have been paying attention have known for some time, that many of tomorrow's movie directors are today's YouTubers. Take Adelaide's Philippou brothers. They were building an audience online for years before they transitioned to the big screen, and they made that transition in a spectacular way. Their debut feature, Talk to Me, sparked a bidding war after it premiered at Sundance. And it's a similar case with Obsession. Obsession's director, Curry Barker, is a horror and comedy content creator who made two very good horror films that went viral. The Chair, which was a short of about 20 minutes, and a shorter feature called Milk and Cereal. Check out both. They're on YouTube. They're up. You don't have to pay anything. He arrives to the big screen fully formed in a sense. He's a director with an aptitude for suspenseful, character-driven horror in long takes. And you saw a bit of that style develop in the two films I've just mentioned. His big screen debut, however, takes things to a next level. Here, in a work of psychological complexity, I think, he's externalized the worst of male entitlement in a twisted story about romantic obsession.
I love you so, 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 so much. A love only the branch of a willow tree could conjure.
It's weird how you two are dating all of a sudden. Like, super dating.
I think Nikki is going through something.
Like what? Is she okay?
No.
I love you.
I love you!
Hello, I'm Jason DeRosso. This is The Screen Show, and it's very much a horror episode this week. Later, I'll be looking at the horror of the Australian real estate market in a new film that pits boomer parents against millennials that comes from Perth. It's called Birthright. But we do begin with Obsession, a film whose premise could be a Twilight Zone episode about a young man who buys a trinket from an occult store that promises to grant any wish. And he uses it to cast a spell on his crush, a young woman in his friend group who all work together at a suburban music store. He casts the spell one night after he drives her home and fumbles his lines in the car, trying to tell her his true feelings. And to his surprise, it works almost instantly. The shot holds, he's in the front of the car when he makes the wish, and she barely has time to get up to her front door. But he is not prepared for just how things will play out, how obsessed and possessive she will become. What begins as a sort of lottery ticket win for him becomes the stuff of nightmares. His nightmares, but also, it should be said, hers. There's something particularly icky and disturbing about the horror in Obsession, about how this premise plays out, and it has to do with the nice guy image of the protagonist, Bear, played by Michael Johnston, and how his nice guy image plays with our sympathies as an audience. How we soon realize that as terrible as it is for him to be dealing with a girlfriend who has the one-eyed obsession of a zombie, it's really much, much worse for her. She didn't choose this, and she has no choice in how the spell compels her to act in more and more extreme ways as he tries to make an exit. Except fleetingly, there are moments where she does appear to maybe remember who she once was. Ultimately, Obsession brings us face to face with male entitlement and misogyny in all its cruelty via this mild-mannered young man. And in this, it reminded me a bit of William Wyler's The Collector, about a young man who kidnaps and imprisons a young woman in his house. That was an adaptation of the John Fowles book, of course. And I think, in a sense, both works are about nice guys whose loneliness masks an immaturity and disregard for others. It's no surprise to me that Curry Barker, on the strength of this movie and his online films, has been tapped on the shoulder to direct the reboot of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You'll meet him in a moment, but first to the actor Indy Navarrete. She's of Mexican-Australian heritage, and she plays Nikki, the girl in Obsession, who's dragged in to this horrific scenario.
Look, you're so beautiful, and you are normal, but this isn't okay, Nikki. Do you like me?
What? Mommy.
No. Do you like me? Do you even like me at all? Is Nikki happy? Does Nikki like me?
Yeah. I'm your freaky Nikki.
Indy Navarrete, welcome to The Screen Show. It's a great pleasure to meet you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's an honor being on.
This is a fantastic performance. And I have to ask you about the nature of this performance being so kind of extreme, I think. Your character undergoes this transformation in behavioral terms, but there's also a physical transformation. It's also a film in which you need to get your hands dirty. Let's put it that way. There are bodily fluids. There are all sorts of things. What was the biggest challenge?
Oh, I think the biggest challenge was just trying things that I've never done before. I think this is the first time that I've done work like this. It was great because it was such a small crew. So after a week of doing, we shot everything in the house first, which, without spoiling anything, a lot of crazy things happen in the house. In Bear's house. And so after having, you know, a week and a half of just that, I think I felt like I could take over the world afterwards. I felt like it was a lot easier to film everything else. But I definitely feel like the challenge at first was kind of getting on my feet with trying to not think about how insane the things that I am doing are.
Well, because when your character is transformed by what essentially is like an evil spell, really.
Right.
Did you always have in your head this idea that baseline, my character is still this person, but she is only existing as that person beneath all these layers of madness and manipulation?
Yeah, I really, that was kind of my my safety line, if you will. I think that's the phrase of I really wanted to humanize her because I really wanted this villain, if you will, to be horrifically human and horrifically real. It wasn't hyperbolic. It wasn't supernatural. It wasn't any of those things. It was what a human outside like you and I are physically capable of doing. And that's what I think made it extremely horrific. But I wanted the audience to empathize with her because obviously she has another version of herself that is underneath all of this, that is the real person.
And you get glimpses of that, don't you? I mean, there's this terrifying moment where your character talks about being haunted by your dreams and not wanting to sleep.
Yeah. We played with this idea of, does the real version of her see what's going on? Or does she kind of pop in and out like she's transporting? Like what level, what can she see? And so in the beginning of the film, we kind of play with her going inside of the house, the wish is made. And then she comes out with the wish overtaking every aspect of her and her, the real version of her popping out saying, whoa, where am I? Like we played with the idea that at the beginning, she doesn't know what's going on. And then she's kind of fighting tooth and nail to be able to see through her own eyes.
Because this strikes me as a date rape allegory, right? Involving drugs. This to me is... I was watching the film thinking it begins as a straight male fantasy where you make a wish and the girl of your dreams becomes besotted with you. She loves you. There's no questions asked. She's transformed into someone who just loves you unquestionably.
Yeah.
And the character in this film then takes advantage of that initially and things start to go crazy. But it occurred to me midway through, I thought, I'm watching a movie about date rape, really. I mean, it's very sort of serious. There's something really, and I think that's what makes it so scary. There's something very disturbing at the core of it.
Yeah. I something that I really appreciated about this film early on was that it means different things to different people, right? Yeah, based on your experiences and your perspective, everybody's going to see this movie differently. So I knew that I saw this movie very similar to yours in the sense that I saw it from Nikki's perspective and how she has no control, she has no consent, and the intention of Bear impacts Nikki in such a way that is extremely horrific because it is a thing that can happen in the world and does, and how horrific that is. And in the beginning, you kind of see them, quote unquote, falling in love, but at what point does it become non-consensual? At what point does who is the villain really flip? Because at a certain point, the main character does realize what's going on and kind of chooses maybe not the best morally, you know, sound choice to kind of keep going. But I definitely feel like that's a strong theme inside of the film as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think at the end, the film's not ambiguous about that, which is great, but we don't want to give it away. I think Michael Johnson's so wonderful in the role because he does come across as this vulnerable, nice guy. And you realize he's not a nice guy at all. He's a coward. And his wish fulfillment is her nightmare. But again, I'm wondering, 100%. You know, I'm wondering, have you watched it with audiences and seen a different kind of reaction between women and straight men in the audience, at least initially? Do you get that sense that women see this very differently?
Yes, I do. I 100% do. And I think it's not just particular to straight men. I think it's men who don't see any problems with Bear's actions, that you can see that there's a difference, right? And also simultaneously within that thought process, the way that they see Nikki. Oh, you know, she's just crazy. She's a crazy girlfriend. She's crazy this, she's crazy that. But the amount of women that have come up to me and has just said, like, I've felt like Nikki before and I've never been able to put it into words because I just get called crazy or I just kind of get shoved into this box where I'm not fully understood. That's meant so much to me because that was really the point that I wanted to drive home with Nikki so that women could watch it and feel humanized and feel understood. And it's still a horror movie at the end of the day, but why being put in that position feels horrific. But it's definitely interesting seeing the different perspectives of people who watch this film and what they have to say. It's kind of telling of where your morals and values are.
Yeah. This is an interesting date night film, actually, because you'll know you're with someone dodgy.
Yes. Yeah, immediately.
Depending on their reaction.
It tells you immediately. So that's why I jokingly, but also very seriously, I'm like, go on a date. Go on a date and watch this movie.
As I say, I should stress to people thinking about going to see this film, the film is not ambiguous towards the end. I think it comes out in a very interesting and sophisticated place. But people listening to you now will not realize from your accent, there'll be no sign at all, of course. You're born in the US, but they will not realize that your mother is actually Australian. Can you tell me a bit about your background and how much you do or do not relate to the Australian part of your heritage?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking that question. So my mom's family is from Brisbane, but specifically Ipswich. And they moved out to the States quite some time ago. You know, my mom and my dad, and so therefore I was born here. But I love the Australian side of my family. And I love going back to Australia. I find myself very connected on both sides of my heritage because I'm Mexican and Australian. And I think a very big similarity between the two is the love for nature and just kind of like this relaxed, hardworking state of, you know, you have a beer, you have a conversation, you're outside, you have no shoes, kids are running around, you're just really relaxed. And you can have serious conversations, but it's just, it's more about human connection and that mixed with nature. But I love being Australian, but yet not a lot of people know about it. It's not something really that I've had to put into words before, but I feel very connected to the Australian side of my family with how much the Australian side of my family, even out here in the US, has brought Australia over here.
Who influenced you most in your decision to go down this road professionally to become an actor and filmmaker, I understand, because I know that you were in a director's lab at Sundance. So I assume you're wanting to get behind the camera as well. Who's influenced you most out of your parents? Or is that an unfair question?
Oh, that's not an unfair question at all. Well, the Australian side of my family is very much into film and was very much into Audrey Hepburn and the Oscars. And yeah, so I would say my mom's side of the family, we would go over to my Aunt Debbie's house and we would watch the Oscars and they would watch Pretty Woman. So I would say the Australian side of my family and then the Mexican side of my family, ironically, but it's ironic now, was really into horror films and I was quite the scaredy cat as a child.
Let's talk about more about the filmmaking. Curry Barker likes to use long takes. How hard is that as an actor, especially when this is an intricate performance because there are so many you know, it gets quite gory. There's action, and the action comes from you doing physical things. So tell me about that challenge.
I think a lot of the preparation that I did really helped with that. I wanted to make sure that I knew what I was saying and knew my lines before showing up to work. That way I could only focus on the physical nature of it. Because I think that being something that I had never done before, I'd memorized lines for other jobs. So I felt like that was kind of a safety net, that if I knew everything that I was saying and my meaning behind it, all I had to worry about was getting the movements correct. So that really, really, really helped the process and the long takes, because I mean, they're long, they're oners, but it's so cool and so gratifying whenever you get them done.
Yeah, I imagine that. I mean, he's such a talented director, I think. And now, of course, he's been tapped on the shoulder to direct the reboot of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which, having seen this film and some of his early films, which are on YouTube, which you can watch for free, I totally understand. He has this sensibility that I think really understands sort of cruelty and perversion that is, of course, you know, central to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but also in this film, you know, he explores that really well.
Right.
What's he like to work with? How did he talk to you about these characters and this situation?
Working with him was pretty unique because he was the youngest director I'd ever worked with. We're the same age. And so what was really neat working with him was I saw somebody kind of at their beginning. This was his first really, really big production. And this was my first time stepping into a role like this. And he had written it and he's also directing it. So he knew what he wanted very specifically. But also at the same time, he was very big on letting us play because he knew that there were things that we could bring to our characters that he didn't see at first because he sat with this for so long. So it was great working with him because whenever I needed direction, I needed to be directed, he was there and he put the structure down and he led the set. But then there were so many beautiful times when we could just play and then he would find something that he didn't think of beforehand. And then that would end up making it into the movie.
Indy, it's been a pleasure speaking to you and good luck with your career in front of the camera and behind the camera as well. I'm sure we'll be seeing more of you and hearing more of you once you get once you get your directorial projects up.
Thank you so much. This interview has been awesome. I really appreciate it.
Indy Navaretti, who is terrific in the new horror movie Obsession. Next up, Curry Barker. But first, another clip from the film.
You love me more than anyone in the world?
Yes, more than anyone.
Nikki.
Yeah?
Does your dad really have cancer?
No. No, no, no.
What?
No, 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 no.
What?
Why does it matter? I thought we were having a nice day.
We are.
It's okay.
We are.
Curry Barker, welcome to the Screen Show.
Thanks for having me.
This is, I think, such a disturbing film in many ways. It does start off as a be careful what you wish for cautionary tale. But what I particularly love about it is the way that you've constructed a narrative that kind of, it deliberately toys with audience perceptions of who's the victim here. And I've spoken to Indy Navaretti about her fantastic performance already, but can I ask you about Michael Johnston and this idea of casting a guy who looks like a nice guy?
Yeah, I mean, he was perfect. I mean, when he first came in, I was like, I knew that he was kind of what I was looking for. I thought that he might be too attractive at first. You know, I was like, maybe he's too much of a pretty boy. But then the more he like played it, he played it super awkward. And he was like, he was really good at, but also like he looked like maybe he could have a chance with her or maybe he could have a chance with Sarah. So it really kind of started to all shape together. But what he brought to it was this like innocence, this false innocence, right? Because we clearly see later that he's not so innocent, but it was the way he played the innocence that really was like, oh, yes, this is what we're looking for.
Yeah, he's so good. And I think as the film unfolds, one of the most horrific things about this conceptually is that you realize this guy doesn't have any empathy or very little empathy for her. It's all about how his dream is falling apart, and it's all about his perception of it. And he's not thinking he's cast this spell over this person. I'm wondering if you've noticed already a kind of difference between the way that men and women watch this film.
A little bit, but I feel like a lot of men get it pretty quickly. I think like I've chose to shoot this in a way where I'm not telling you the answer. I'm not pointing the camera at Bear's a bad guy. You have to kind of come to that conclusion yourself. But I think that they are. Most of them are very smart, which is, you know, I like to treat my audience smart in every way. When you're expected to be mature, you know, this is rated R, so it's for a mature audience. To me, mature also means smart. And so I think it's funny when movies kind of spoon feed the audience, if you know, because we're telling people that you have to be a certain age and a certain maturity level to watch these films. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Look, but just on that notion of be careful what you wish for, which is partly what this film's exploring, you've had a fantastic run career-wise in recent months. You've been tapped on the shoulder to direct the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You've got this film in cinemas that's getting very well reviewed. In a sense, I imagine you're in this moment in your career where everything you've wished for has kind of come about and come true. Do you have an aspect of superstition to the way you view life when things are going well? Do you sort of think, oh, you know, you think they're going too well, I expect something maybe to go wrong? Is this where this film idea comes from even?
I'm not a superstitious guy. I don't really subscribe to any beliefs of really. But I'm also, yeah, I mean, I'm just excited about the future. I mean, I definitely worry that like my next film won't be as good. I'm always worried about not living up to my last film. You know, even when Milk and Cereal came out, I thought that movie was meh, to say the least. I thought that movie was okay.
Really? Really?
Yeah, I never thought much of it. I never thought much of Obsession either. I mean, I always kind of just, I do my best and I work really hard on the things and they became my baby. But like, you know, I always kind of go through phases where I think they're not very good. And, yeah. So I think even when Milk and Cereal came out, I was like just hoping and praying that Obsession would be as good and as well received as Milk and Cereal was. So I'm just taking it one step at a time, you know.
But tell me about the online pathway from online to theatrical, right? So there are so many people like the Philippou brothers in Australia, you know, with Talk to Her and so forth, you know them, Kane Parsons with Backrooms. Right. These are filmmakers, horror filmmakers, that are having enormous success with their theatrical released horror movies that all start online. Can you tell me about that pathway? It feels like it's becoming more and more common. How has it worked for you, and how was the transition to making your first theatrical release?
I think, yeah, because we live in a world where YouTube is a thing, I think there's only so many ways to make it as a filmmaker. Even in history, it was usually you make a bunch of short films, and you hope that someone likes your short film one day and gives you a chance or gives you money. Or maybe you actually save up some money yourself and you make a feature and people like it. But really, YouTube is kind of just a platform that you can put your stuff out there. And I think that it would be silly nowadays to not use it to your advantage. Getting discovered on YouTube is a lot easier than going the festival route and hoping someone. Most of the people that my experience, I did the festival route for a bit, and my experience was that the only people that were discovering my films were the people that were making films at my level, you know? I wasn't really learning, meeting anyone that was going to take me to the next level, so.
Yeah. And what were the horror films that influenced you here? Because I think it is such this is a horror film with a lot of gore, but there is a really strong character-driven element to the way things unfold. And you've got a lot of long takes. So tell me about that. What were the filmmakers or films that influenced you?
I would say Ari Aster, Jordan Peele, even Lee Whannell's The Invisible Man, holding on these long takes and kind of taking their time and not cutting too much and being intentional with your coverage. Not just cutting to something, like, why are we cutting to something? Is a character looking at it? What are we learning when we cut to it? I like to tell my stories from a perspective, you know, is it from Bear's perspective? My least favorite thing is when a director chooses to cut to something and it's just to say, hey, audience, check this out. This is going to be important later. It doesn't feel earned to cut. And I still see a lot of movies doing that, and it makes me roll my eyes. So that, you know, it's something that all my favorite filmmakers, they don't do that. They cut with intention, you know?
And what is it about the original? I mean, now that you're set to direct Texas Chainsaw Massacre, what is it about the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre that you think makes it such an important work of horror?
They were onto something in the 70s that we seldomly see in modern horror films. The rawness and the uncomfortability of that family is something that hasn't been captured since the 70s one. It was something that I was trying to do, an obsession, but you know, there's an uncomfortability to the nonchalantness of their wanting to kill. You know, this family, the Sawyers, they're cannibals. It's not just that they kill viciously, and it's how it's part of their culture in a really creepy, weird way that gets under your skin, you know.
Carrie, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. I look forward to seeing what you do next, and I very much look forward to your take on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Awesome.
Thanks, Carrie. That's been great to speak to you.
Awesome, Jason. Thank you so much.
Curry Barker, a very impressive young director. He's writer-director of the new horror movie Obsession, currently in cinemas. You're listening to The Screen Show on ABC Radio National. For many people, the Australian housing market is its own kind of horror show. And that is, I'd say, a view shared by my next guest, who is a theatre maker turned filmmaker from Perth, Zoe Pepper. Her debut feature is a darkly funny, heightened farce called Birthright, a chamber piece about a young millennial couple, Corey and Jasmine, played by Travis Jeffrey and Maria Angelico, who have nowhere to live. They've been kicked out of their expensive rental, they're between jobs, and Jasmine is also very, very pregnant. So, Corey drives them both to his parents' place in a small car packed with all their earthly belongings. The house is a grand bungalow in a leafy suburb, and the couple hope to be warmly welcomed, at least for a couple of weeks, while they get their life back together. They get anything but. In a setup that is perhaps just a tad difficult to fully believe, but you just have to roll with it, Corey's mum and dad, Richard and Lynn, played by Michael Hurst and Linda Cropper, are both nonplussed, to say the least. They are a couple who value their alone time, their tinkering time, their gardening time, and they are more than a little bit resentful that this couple are asking for help, especially when it emerges the young people weren't too keen on including them in their lives previously. Before you can say, okay, boomer, both couples are in a bitter standoff. The millennials have nowhere to go and perhaps are a little too entitled about what they want from this situation and from Corey's parents in very concrete financial terms. And the boomers are not in a conciliatory mood at all. This is a very well-performed film, a satire of the kind of intergenerational tensions we've seen play out in recent years in various places, from the social media space to federal political economic policy. Although I did struggle, as I mentioned earlier, to fully believe the setup,
I can't quite buy that these parents would be quite this callous, especially when there's a daughter-in-law who's so heavily pregnant. If you are particularly invested in these themes of Australia's cooked housing market and intergenerational warfare, you will probably find this film quite a cathartic experience, an opportunity in a darkened room to exercise some of your deepest held frustrations and anger. And I'm talking about both generations here. It looks great. Zoe Pepper directs performances very well. And a shout out to cinematographer Michael McDermott, a veteran of the WA screen scene, who transforms this trophy suburban home into an atmospheric house of horrors. Zoe Pepper coming up.
In those days, you only had one jacket.
One jacket, one jumper.
No pants.
We appreciated what we had. We looked after it. And then bit by bit, we turned one jacket, one jumper, into a whole house.
Two investment properties.
Do you want to disrespect us after everything we've done for you? Who did you turn to when you needed help? Who cooked your dinner? Who put a roof over your head? Who's paying the bills while you find your feet?
Zoe Pepper, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thanks for having me.
You've picked a really great moment to release this film.
Yeah, budget night, look out. Yeah.
Well, by the time we're going to air, it'll be a week after the budget, but certainly we're in a moment where there's a lot of conversation around housing and a lot of conversation around structural issues that young people especially face in getting into the housing market.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and intergenerational inequality more broadly, which is kind of the real foundation of the film, for sure.
Does this come from personal experience? I'm not saying that what unfolds over this crazy night in your film, well, towards the end of the film anyway, happened in your life. I'm not suggesting that. But more broadly, does it come from a personal place?
I mean, to an extent, for sure. Like it is expressing a frustration at kind of getting to a certain age and not being where you thought you would be, and kind of like there's a lot of shame and sense of failure attached with that. And that is kind of part of the impetus for the film, as well as seeing friends of mine like in a similar situation where they were forced to move back home with their parents and always intended it to be quite a short stay, and then it extends, and it's a real curiosity around the power dynamics playing out under that one roof. And it kind of really revealed itself as a great microcosm that kind of spoke to what was happening in Australia more broadly.
You say the word shame, which I think is really interesting, because, I mean, often we can talk about these issues in terms of the cold hard facts of economics, I suppose. But there is a psychological element to this inequity and to the situation that many younger people find themselves in, isn't there? And it is about, I suppose, big words like dignity and self-worth and shame. Explore for me, if you could, how shame enters into the equation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a bit more multifaceted housing. Like, it's so integral to how you live and like to living a decent life. And that, yes, the film taps into like a resentment between generations because of kind of these inequities, but also there's a shame because it's like the relationship with the baby boomers, between the millennials and the baby boomers, is made complex because there's a love there. Like they are family, and there's a need to kind of like get their approval and kind of want to feel like you're doing good in your parents' eyes. So I think the shame is wrapped up in that. Yes, it's like facts and figures and, you know, percentage charts and things, but it's really kind of, the film looks at the impact on a generation's psyche in a way.
What's interesting to me too is that as you're watching it, I think the film's is open enough to various interpretations. And one of the interpretations that's possible, I think, is that at least for a moment in this film, I think everyone will think, has this young man especially perhaps invested too much in his parents' vision of the world and what should be expected or what he should be achieving? And in a way, is he in some way, to some degree, beholden to an idea of what he should have. And the pool comes into that, perhaps. I'm not saying that he shouldn't want a house and shouldn't want affordable housing, but there's this aspect of the way he's internalized his parents' view of the world, perhaps, that's maybe not good for him.
Oh, absolutely. And there's entitlement on screen, absolutely, with the millennial generation. And that I did try and kind of craft the film in a way that your empathy keeps shifting and that no generation comes out unscathed, that, yeah, the millennials are not kind of like, you know, they don't get out scot-free, that he absolutely put a lot of stock in kind of that he saw what his parents achieved and that they worked hard and they kind of like have this house and this very middle class life. And he thought it was his rite of passage and that, yeah, he's entitled and he thinks he should just be, it's his birthright in a way.
Yeah, hence the name of the film. Yeah. And hence this theme, this motif of this pool, this below-ground pool that has been covered over by the father. And subsequently throughout the film, this young man who moves back in with his heavily pregnant wife back into the, you know, family home, he becomes obsessed with digging up this pool. Where did that idea come from?
The pool was symbolic of home ownership, and it was like him kind of like a way for him to take what he thinks he deserves. But I also think about the film as kind of running on an emotional logic rather than a cognitive logic, like that these characters, through the isolation of the film, like it's four actors in one house and I chose a location that's very enclosed, so that it's like they fall back on their most kind of internalized desires in terms of like what he thought he wanted to be when he grew up, what he thought is, you know, this is his desires from when he was a child. And yeah, let that kind of fuel and kind of be the driving engine for the film so that they can descend into their own kind of madness.
Now, you're based in Perth, aren't you?
Yeah.
And this is shot in Perth.
Yeah.
Perth is a city that has had, I suppose, a pretty volatile housing market, but at the moment it's really very, very hot, I think is the term.
Yes.
Prices are really high. Do you think you would have made this film had you not been in Perth and witnessed that over the last few years? I mean, was this really playing on your mind a lot?
Yeah, it really was. Like, I started writing it in 2021, and that was like when things started to go properly insane. Like, average time on the market for a house was like 5 days.
Wow.
That kind of situation where it's like you spend more time buying a pair of jeans than you do buying a house in terms of like how quickly people have to act and make a decision and just like go into mountains of debt. So yeah, that stress and that kind of anxiety that is attached to a market that is that hot was definitely kind of like infused in the film.
Because it's not like Sydney, Perth. I mean, I remember I know people who sold a house at a loss, I think, about 6 or 7 years ago. So, you know, it's been a real roller coaster. It hasn't been this constant kind of move upwards. So to see this acceleration over the past few years must have been really scary for people.
Yeah, definitely. And look, I was paranoid when I was writing it that I was like, oh God, the bubble's going to burst and the film's not going to be relevant anymore. But really quite the opposite happened and it kind of doubled down and got exponentially worse. I mean, it's interesting in a way. I think that the impact that's had on how the film might be received is that I think baby boomers have become overall more sympathetic to the cause of the millennials because it's just gotten kind of undeniable in terms of how unaffordable housing is. So yeah, maybe like in 2021 when I was writing it, your kind of avocado on toast articles were still around, whereas I feel like they just don't fly anymore.
Well, I was going to say, you've already been showing this film around the country to audiences. What, who is the audience for this film and who turns out to this film?
Yeah, look, we played a lot of festivals last year and like that attracted a lot of millennial audiences. And I do really want both baby boomers and millennials to come along and see this film. It was interesting. We played a festival at Cinefest Oz, which was a much older crowd.
Down in Busselton.
Yeah,
down in Busselton. Australia, right. What did they make of it? Did you get a sense of what older people make of this film?
It was interesting. Like, I feel like it actually landed more the way that I intended it, that with younger audiences, they tend to like laugh all the way through to the end. Whereas the tragedy kind of really landed much more you know, much more heavily with a with an older crowd, that there was a really reflective kind of energy with the audience.
Zoe Pepper, writer-director of Birthright, which is in cinemas around Australia right now, ruffling feathers, I'm sure. Go and see it with your parents or maybe your adult children. See how you get on. I'm Jason DeRosso. You've been listening to The Screen Show. Thanks as ever to producer Sarah Corbett. We'll be back with another episode in a week. Until then, bye for now and good luck at the auctions.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.